Last on the $6 million man, Steve Austin was reunited with his childhood sweetheart, Jamie Summers. When she was severely injured in a tragic accident, Steve persuaded Oscar Goldman to make Jamie into the world's first bionic woman. Steve and Jamie were planning to marry, but then something went wrong.
Jamie's body is rejecting her bionics. We've got to operate immediately.
I don't know, it was like she just went out of her head.
Jamie was driven to near madness by intolerable pain. Steve pursued her into the night.
We're losing her. She's still slipping, Rudy.
Respiration is only 2 per minute. She's fading.
Heart rate dropping rapidly. Blood pressure falling off, Rudy.
Oh, dear God. She's got a massive cerebral hemorrhage.
No reaction from the adrenaline.
Respiration is still dropping.
The vital signs are going.
How's the line voltage?
It's off. If she could be conscious, she would be.
Pulse down to... I can't find it.
To Steve Austin and the world, Jamie was dead. But was she? Now, the return of the bionic woman on The $6 Million Man.
Welcome to World First Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Clank.
And I am Troy Harkin.
This is the second part of our cyborg celebration, in which we look back on the bionic shows, The $6 Million Man and The Bionic Woman.
And a quick note, make sure you stay tuned to the end of the episode when we'll have a special bionic treat for you. It's courtesy of sci-fi legend Robert J. Sawyer. In our previous episode, we covered the origins of the $6 million man, and we had just met the love of Colonel Steve Austin's life, Jamie Summers, when ABC mercilessly killed her off. In doing so, breaking Steve's heart and the heart of every viewer that was tuned in.
And ABC faced the wrath of the American public. Hundreds of thousands of letters were sent. One prominent psychologist wrote, "How dare you create such a brilliant archetype for women to admire and pattern themselves after, and then so brutally kill her?" So ABC backpedaled hard and fast. They ordered Universal to find a way to resurrect Jamie Summers. As it turned out, Jamie was no longer under a Universal contract, and actress Lindsay Wagner was not particularly keen on returning. So in order to make it happen, much money was paid and would continue to be paid to Lindsay Wagner.
The third season of The $6 Million Man would kick off with a two-part episode, The Return of the Bionic Woman. As it turns out, a wunderkind protege of Rudy Wells, Dr. Michael Marchetti, was able to save Jamie after she was declared dead. She was brought to a clinic in Colorado to convalesce and to recover from her post-death amnesia. Steve ended up at the same facility after being hurt on a mission, and he discovers Jamie is there. He learns of her amnesia. He learns that she has no idea who he is. And he learns that she is smitten with her attending physician, the Boo Hiss, aforementioned Michael Scumbag Marchetti. Now, we understand that the character of Marchetti is created to double down on the heartbreak that Steve is experiencing. But sweet and sour Jesus, people have a heart. And has Dr. Marchetti never heard of doctor-patient ethics, particularly when dealing with mentally vulnerable patients like Jamie Summers?
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
It's pretty incredible, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Are there many people that are bionic?
Only you and Steve.
Who's Steve?
I am. I'm Steve.
Hi. Haven't I seen you before? Or was it a few days ago?
Yeah, a few days ago.
Right, you walked in just as I was waking up. And you looked at me so strangely.
Yeah, well, it was a shock learning that you were still alive.
Mm. Well, I wouldn't be if it weren't for Michael.
Yay, at least for Jamie. Jamie's alive. But boo. There's a hole in her heart where Steve Austin used to live. And now this scumbag doctor is now inhabiting. Return of the Bionic Woman ultimately is a bittersweet experience. ABC's Fred Silverman was so taken with Wagner's performance and her ability to draw an audience that he wanted her to carry her own series. So in the $6 Million Man episode, Welcome Home, Jamie, we get a two-parter that crosses over into the launch of the Bionic Woman series. And thankfully, she leaves behind the piece of human garbage, the cuckolding ethics nightmare, Dr. Michael Marchetti or Marchetti or whatever the heck
whatever.
His last name is.
Whatever. Good riddance to whatever they say.
I think people were applauding it. When she got on that plane and he's left behind, I think people were cheering at that point.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, it's like, way to go. Because I don't think viewers would have stuck around had he been a part of the story. I don't think so anyway, but whatever. By that time, something else was established. Viewers loved crossover episodes with Steve and Jamie. It was great TV, and they drew viewers. Some of the best episodes of either series were ones featuring Steve and Jamie. No surprise, they're also ones that people still remember. Dave, you and I were lucky enough to live in a time that gave us both fembots and Bigfoot. God bless America.
Steve, we're being up!
Marlene, do you read?
Well, what is it?
There's only one thing in the mountains that leaves a track like this.
My people named him Sasquatch. You call him Bigfoot.
Yes. The Secret of Bigfoot.
Woo! Woo!
Was a $6 Million Man two-parter with a cameo by the Bionic Woman. It was a season three episode that aired on February 1st and 4th. In it, Steve faces off against Bigfoot. I'm sorry, that just sounds ridiculous. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, I have to tell you that there was a point at which Jamie Summers did an episode called Jamie Summers. My God. Lindsay Wagner proposed an episode called Biofeedback, which was about things like mindfulness and meditation. And one of the producers said to her, "Oh, that's not realistic." And she said, "We just did an episode with Bigfoot and fembots, and you're telling me this isn't realistic?"
It's amazing how, because I wasn't even that aware. Like, I don't know if Legend of Boggy Creek was around that time, a bit before or after. But there was also all these things about Bigfoot and Sasquatch and so on, even up to today. And one of my jokes is there's a series now called In Search of Bigfoot. And it's in its sixth season, starting its sixth season. So I was thinking, you know, if you want to stream it, you might want to skip seasons 1 through 5. You know, you might just want to do that.
Spoiler, yeah. They haven't found him yet.
Well, they're still looking for Bigfoot in season six. So anyways, so about this episode.
In you were Steve saying.
Sorry. As I was saying, in it, Steve faces off against Bigfoot. And we learn that the Sasquatch is basically a robot.
Oh.
It's a robot, probably with one of those faceplate thing. But anyways, it's a robot created by intelligent, human-like aliens living in the mountains of California. You can't make this shit up, by the way.
No, but apparently like, somebody
can you imagine the can you imagine the elevator's pitch? Yeah, we want some Sasquatch that's created by some intelligent, human-like aliens living in the mountains of California. Yes. That episode. We'll give you the green light right away.
And I have to tell you, and this is true. Bigfoot is real. No, that's not it. So I had totally forgot the bit about Bigfoot having like robot parts. Mm. And about 5 years ago, I came up with this idea that involved a Sasquatch. And in it, one of the characters proposes that Sasquatch is actually an alien. And he refers to the Sasquatch as Sasqualien. Sasqualien is what he calls them. And I thought this was an original idea. I thought it was a hilarious original idea. And then when I rewatched this, it was like, oh shit, I just buried this from my childhood.
Mm.
Anyway, I'm sorry, Dave.
No, don't worry about
the first Bigfoot episode. And I'm
just imagine if Bigfoot was first really talked about 150 years ago, then it would be Sasquatch Centennial.
Yeah,
I've gone too far with
Sasquatch.
Okay, I can't. So let's get back to reality. Back to Bigfoot. So, and by the way, a real Bigfoot was not used for no Bigfoot were injured during this. There's a little note at the end of the episode, but anyways, rather wrestling legend Andre the Giant. Now, I think Ted Cassidy at some point comes in, but we weren't even that aware of him. Andre the Giant became a big thing, so to speak, years later, and he was also in Princess Bride and so on. So anyways, rather wrestling legend Andre the Giant played the part of Bigfoot. Lee Majors was concerned that the 400-pound wrestler would trip and fall on him in some of the fight scenes. Fortunately for Majors, this never happened.
Stephanie Powers, who I know you're a fan of, plays the alien Shalon, who crushes hard on Colonel Austin.
How long will you be here?
3 more years. Our ship won't come to get us until then. Tell me something, Colonel. What makes a woman attractive in your world?
Well, that depends on who you talk to. For me, a woman needs intelligence, a sense of humor.
Physical attributes?
Well, every little bit helps. Why? What sort of man would you consider attractive?
Someone like you.
You know, Doctor, when I first met you, your bedside manner did surprise me a little bit. You treat all your patients that way?
Of course not. But I've been stuck here with those stuffy scientists for 2 years. You were like a breath of fresh air. Not only attractive and witty, but also bionic. My specialty. Every little bit helps. Operation I want you to help me with.
What sort of operation?
One I think you'll enjoy.
Another of the aliens was played by Severn Darden, who I immediately recognized from Conquest and Battle for the Planet of the Apes. The aliens use their super drug, and this sounds like a real drug, Neotraxin, to save Steve after his scrape with Bigfoot. Then they mind wipe him, and Bigfoot returns the colonel safely to the woods. Lee Majors has said, Bigfoot became our staple. If we wanted a 45% share, all we would have to do is pop in Bigfoot.
The second multi-part Bigfoot extravaganza came to us in season 4 and is suitably christened The Return of Bigfoot.
I wonder what that episode was about.
I think it might have been about Bigfoot returning, but that's just a guess.
Anyway.
this time, yep. Ted Cassidy took on the mantle of the Sasquatch. Just imagine the mantle of the Sasquatch. It seems a rogue bunch of those, again, California mountain-dwelling aliens, which sounds like a reality show today, are using Bigfoot to do their evil bidding.
Steve investigates in his memories of Shalon, let's call her Stephanie Powers, and the aliens return. But when Steve is downed by radiation poisoning, Jamie steps up to save the life of, can we say, fiance? Of her Steve.
Hey, put a ring on it, guy.
Yeah.
No, just kidding.
I feel like I've been mind wiped by the aliens. No one should watch 8 years worth of TV in a month. Anywho, Jamie finds the wonder drug Neotraxin. She doses Steve, and the two of them go back to the mountains to fight the baddies who have brainwashed their pal Bigfoot. We forgot to tell you, John Saxon is one of the baddies, so there's that.
We can't tell you how it ends. But we can tell you there is a hilarious fight segment where Steve, Jamie, and Bigfoot toss one of the baddies around like he's a hot potato. I can also tell you that Bigfoot helps to save the day as he works hand in hand in paw with his bionic friends.
Are you certain you won't reconsider?
No, we can't stay with you.
We must get home, but thank you for letting us keep our memory of you.
Tell Charlotte, and this time I won't forget.
Nor will she forget you.
Goodbye, Gillian.
Goodbye, Jamie.
And you get a big bionic hug. Waking up in a new century sure is tempting.
Yeah.
By the way, for these Bigfoot episodes, the entrance to the aliens' grotto is accessed via a long bridge with a spinning tunnel around it. The tunnel was a part of the Universal Studios tour until 2013 when it was destroyed. Supposedly, walking along the narrow 61-meter tunnel was quite difficult as it causes vertigo. Everyone hated having to walk on it, as Steve and Jamie do at the end of The Return of Bigfoot. Now, much earlier in The Secret of Bigfoot, when Sasquatch carries the unconscious Steve Austin along the bridge, Lee Majors was sure Andre the Giant was going to topple over the side with him in his arms. He was petrified, but the big man did not drop him, let him down, or anything.
We did get a third standalone Bigfoot episode in the final season of The $6 Million Man called Bigfoot 5. Once again, Bigfoot was played by Ted Cassidy. I think he was Lurch, I think, in Adam's Family.
Yeah.
And because there is, and I was just thinking today about the idea of big ass actors, and they should form a union called the Big Ass Actors Association of America, or BAAA. And you've got Ted Cassidy, you've got Richard Kiel, you've got Andre the Giant, you've got all of the, because you need, every so often you need a big ass actor to step in and do their big ass actor job.
Yeah.
I think I've gone too far, and this may end up on the editing room floor.
Oh no, I've lost my editing scissors. I have to tell you that okay, when you did the this is something that didn't make it to my notes, but I will add it here. So there's an episode of The Bionic Woman in which it involves nuns. And in the scene, Oscar Goldman is trying to access this convent. And there's sort of a setup that's trying to stop him. So what the nuns have done is they've created this roadblock with these sheep. this flock of sheep. And so Oscar comes up and he's like frantically trying to get into the convent grounds. And he says this line. I just want to deliver it properly. Sisters, you have to get the flock out of here. Richard Anderson actually thought that, you know, the network's never going to let us use that line, but they do. And it's hilarious. So I just wanted to share that with you. Get the flock out of here.
And that was my favorite sweaters. Going back to sweaters, I had this sweater that had this guy in this sweater. It was a room with a whole bunch of sheep. And the phrase at the end, of course, is get the flock out of here. So, and because as we get back to a Bigfoot 5, the standalone episode, and because there's no bionic woman and not a crossover, that's all we're going to say about that one. And here's a little clip.
There's nothing to fear. When you wake up, you're going to be well. Pleasant dreams until that day comes, my friend.
And it's time to move on to Fembots.
It's always a good time to move on to Fembots. And I know you're going to have something to say about this. John Houseman plays smug mad scientist Dr. Franklin. All right, I've been into the drinks. Dr. Franklin. He's pissed that the OSI snubbed his idea to use robots and went with bionics instead. Now he's going to use his Fembot robots, a.k.a. Fembots, to take control of their weather control machine. We get a lot of Fembots losing their faceplates, Dave. Woohoo, yep. Baby, risque. Mm. Fembots dropping their faceplates. And that's hearkening back to the Day of the Robot episode that harkens back to the Westworld, that harkens back to the Twilight Zone. And I'm sorry for throwing my name around like that. Anyway, according to writer-producer Kenneth Johnson, a lot of parents told me that the trilogy terrified their kids. I had no idea it had that much of an impact. Clearly, it impacted comedian Mike Myers as he incorporated Fembots into his Austin Powers trilogy.
Austin Powers is getting too close. Any suggestions?
Jawohl, Herr Doctor. I have created the ultimate weapon to defeat Austin Powers. Bring in the Fembots!
As a three-parter, Kill Oscar feels like it could have been released theatrically. God knows there were worse motion pictures released in the 1970s.
As a side note, through most of his series, Lee Majors plays Steve Austin with his shirt at least half undone. In Kill Oscar, he goes through the climax of the final installment entirely shirtless and in shorts. It's sort of like shirtless in Seattle or something like that. Then he is drenched by Dr. Franklin's weather machine. Just saying. In the third season of The Bionic Woman, Fembots return, but without Steve Austin to get in their way. Fembots in Las Vegas is the name of the episode, and incidentally, the elevator pitch as well. Here's a clip.
Good Lord, Oscar, I didn't know you kept all this stuff.
Yes, it's all sealed evidence.
Like walking through a haunted house.
Yeah. I'll be with you in a minute.
Oh, no. You kept this too, huh?
Yeah, we very nearly bought the farm that time. Remember? What did Dr. Franklin call those female robots? Fembots? Machines?
Programmable, obedient, and as beautiful or as deadly as I choose to make them.
That's it. I'm the way outside.
Hey, why the stampede?
Oh, Oscar, I'm sorry. I can't help it. This place got me so spooked. I'm hearing that transistor hum again.
Jamie, they'll never operate again. Dr. Franklin died in prison 2 months ago. She's only alive in your memory, babe.
Carl Franklin, the son of the man who created the Fembots, has taken over the family business And now he wants revenge. Lizzie Wagner has gone on record saying the episode is not one of her favorites. But how do you pass up on a Fembot episode? So maybe I've got a few notes I wanted to just mention because I did more of a deep dive into the three part. This won't take a long time, but I figured
it's fine.
Why not do some of the stuff? Let me go into my quick notes on Kill Oscar Part 1. I love the Learjet and Katie. The phrase, John Houseman's amazing. One of the things I don't want to forget is the idea of John Houseman and Lindsay Wagner, because both of them, I don't know if it came before or after, it may have come after, but there was a movie called The Paper Chase.
Right.
Where Lindsay Wagner plays the daughter of Professor Kingsfield. And The Paper Chase is such a good film. And there was a series, which was a very good series, TV show, that was based on the movie. They did switch up some of the actors. You could, of course, not replace John Houseman. How can anyone else play Professor Kingsfield? But I love at the beginning, he says, they pay the fiddler, so we must dance. There's a bit of exposition. One of the bad guys shows up and he talks about his board of directors cannot finance you for the weather control device currently under development by the OSI. But instead of doing this, you squandered. And he gives this whole exposition thing. And it reminds me of Mike Myers from Wayne's World or Dark Helmet, where he turns to the screen and says, did everyone get that?
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to. And then there's this whole thing. There's some interesting and strange things that they say, which is a bit problematic and odd. They do refer to the trying to take over the secretaries because they are the glue that holds OSI together. They handle account details, implementing command decisions, managing phone calls, making appointments, scheduling conferences. Secretaries are the most important members of this chart. And then they refer to them as strategically located ladies, which I thought was a, that could be a name of a band for God's
sake. Yeah.
SLL. I love John House. John Houseman's so good. Like he's got there. He's already realized you show that one of the people he's been conversing with, Katie, removed the faceplate. He had no idea. And of course, John Houseman already has the directors on the line with the phone. Says, what would you like to say to, like, you know, he's won that round.
Yeah.
What else was there? There was this little, I don't know where.
Well, you also get the chauvinism from Houseman's character, too, which I thought was interesting. It's like, you don't think much of women, but you created these fembots. So I also made me wonder, well, maybe you created them for other reasons, too. I don't know.
Yeah, I had a quote from what he actually says early on in referring to them as a perfect woman. They're programmable and obedient, but the...
which is a little Stepford Wives like.
Well, when he says something like John Houseman, he talks about the girl is valuable, fembots can do anything she can, and the guy says, not quite. As a human being, she can think for herself, something that the fembots can't do. And he replies, since when is thinking for herself an asset in a woman? And I was thinking, this is like, and there's an extreme close up of people's sweating faces. But a few things is the handball game, which is kind of interesting. Say, oh, let's just go and test our bionics. Well, it's good that we have this handball court at the facilities. And also the whole thing with Oscar Goldman and not encouraging people. And there was one phrase is who is going to tell him what's in his drawers, which I always thought was a very funny, moment.
Right. Hey, I've got a question for you.
When
Steve and Jamie are in the submarine approaching the island, and they crawl into, I guess, the torpedo shaft.
Yeah.
Is the idea that they're shot out of the torpedo shaft?
I think.
Or do they swim out?
Yeah, because with the torpedo, generally the torpedoes themselves would have their own propeller thing. They would fill water in the thing, open up the outer drawer, and then the propeller. I don't think there's anything that... It's the propeller itself.
Okay, I believe,
but I could be wrong about that.
No,
but I was weird. It looked like they were going in backwards. Like they had them head first towards the ship.
Right.
I would think that they would head be out there. But then there's other ways of them being able to get out, because they could have gone out from the top of the ship. Like, I just found it a bit odd that they would be going out that way.
Yeah, because, I mean, I'm good with suspending disbelief, but I was having a bit of an issue with the logistics of that part of it. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
There's this nice thing with Jamie and the Secretary Callahan.
Oh, God, where I love Callahan.
The line keeps just ringing, and I was thinking that, you know, but it's all those people who are calling to try to book time on the handball court that's tying it all up. Like, they just should have a separate line for that. Yep. Let me see what else we have. Oh, the instructions, of course, to play it in the event of my capture is cool. The glasses, Oscar Goldman's glasses coming on and coming off, is almost the best he's done in the whole series. It's very perfect to capture the moment or the mood, or if you're serious, right? You get closer to someone, you take off your glasses, stare them in the face, and make a point. Now, if you do that 5 times an episode for 20 episodes a season for 5 seasons, you start to wonder about that.
Yeah, and we were saying that David Caruso would later adopt that Oscar Goldman move. But it was, I guess, usually sunglasses that he would take off.
Yeah, and he would have that look that he knows that you're the one that he's going after, and he would just do that amazing stare. So I always liked David Caruso. My quick notes on part two is, of course, there's always gratuitous helicopter shots. I don't know if there's an episode that has occurred that doesn't at least have one helicopter moment in it. They had that helicopter, and they had to use it.
Yeah.
The idea of a drinking game with Oscar Goldman taking off his glasses. Rudy gets excited over every so often. There's a moment where Rudy is just getting excited about something.
Right.
I always love that. A phrase like, don't give us that skeptical science look. there's that pencil. I'm sorry that they crushed that pencil, because that was one of the pencils used to fend off a spider in Land of the Giants. And the darn thing should be in the Smithsonian. Right. Instead, he throws it on the ground.
That's right. And that was the tell, right? Wasn't that the tell that this was not? Oscar steps on? It's like, he's heavy, right? He's heavier than the real Oscar.
All right. So one of the beautiful moments is the idea that they're going to catch Steve, and he claims that Steve is actually a robot. All you have to do is take one of these Geiger counters and have it near his legs, and you'll notice that he's obviously a robot. So they do that, and it's setting off this alert. So this guy's got uranium. Like, he's got something that is causing this thing to go off. Yet Steve is going into work every day, hanging around with people, and he's got these legs that are probably killing people around him. And
don't sit with me in the cafeteria, please, Steve.
Yes. One of the things, and I don't know if it's you or me or all of us, the idea of when you jump up on a wall with that bionic, like every so often you're jumping up on this wall and you jump up and you're landing on the top of the wall. Then you have to jump off the wall. I never get tired of that. I just love jumping, and jumping off of walls is just wonderful. Let me just see if there's just one or two left. Oh, the idea of drywall. Like, that's the other reason why the phone is going off the hook, is all these drywall companies calling to offer quotes to repair the place. Bookcases, like, oh, there's a bookcase. I wonder what's going to happen with that later. I have a feeling that someone is going to grab with their bionic arm, pull this bookcase out on top of some evildoer.
Yeah.
I don't know how many times that has happened, but it has happened a lot. Beginning of part three, what I really like is the very beginning where they have that news thing about this. And we tried to reach Oscar Goldman, but all their lines are busy due to people trying to make reservations for the handball court. And contractors trying to reach them to be able to fix their desks, their bookcases, and drywall.
Yeah. And I wanted to know, okay, poor Callahan, the secretary, is so overworked.
Yes.
At the end, why didn't they just bring back the Fembot Callahan, and then they've doubled their workforce? They could have Callahan, the robot, Fembot Callahan, man the phones or something, or at least she could spot her occasionally.
That's an idea. It might bring up other concerns.
Oh, it could be union issues. It just occurred to me.
Yeah,
it'd be probably union things.
We all love Sam Jaffe, who I think was, unless I'm mistaken, went from the movie Day the Earth Stood Still and many other things, but I do love him. And you know, they decide to move all this weather equipment to St. Emile Island in the Caribbean, which, of course, you know, how about thinking about air conditioning when you're moving all this stuff over there? Because everyone's sweating their asses off. And also the idea that they can move all this stuff from this high powered security place, probably in the US, say, oh, I'm Oscar Goldman, I'm not a robot, and I need you to move all this stuff over to St. Emile Island. Well, right. That's not even one of our official sites. Like, why are you sending it? Well, just do it.
I have a feeling, by the way, that it occurred to me, okay, we have Steve running around in his knickers, right?
Yes.
And yet, in this era of what was known as like the TNA era, which sounds like Tierra, TNA era, Jamie is not in like whatever, her bikini or whatever, after she arrives on the island after being shot out of the submarine.
Yeah.
Now, yet we had shows like Charlie's Angels happening where they did whatever they could to make sure they were wearing bikinis. I think that because Lindsay Wagner had negotiated so well in order to have the Bionic Woman take off, I think she had probably had a say in that. So I think it's kind of interesting that it's almost like reverse sexism in the final act where, you know, Steve is like, you know, running around doing his boy toy thing. And Lindsay is not. Anyway, just an interesting note, I thought.
No, absolutely. I just have a couple more notes. The whole point where they have all these high level people deciding how to handle this whole weather emergency, and they have this terrible red background with this white writing saying, well, plan one is to do this, plan two and plan, it just looks awful. Jamie Summers shows up, and Steve and Rudy, and no one had really met Jamie before, so of course Steve may introduce Jamie Summers. She is a tennis player and a high school teacher. He doesn't really say that, but they had this high level thing with all this high clearance.
Yeah.
And he's brought someone that doesn't, but of course they do make it clear that yes, she is part of the group and does have the proper, you know, level.
Yeah. You
of
think
security.
She wouldn't be allowed into the room. You know, you think that would have had to have happened prior to entering the room.
Yep. And I've just got one last thing. I think, just the ending of it, where you finally get John Houseman's character understanding or so on. At some point, he says to her, Jamie Summers, you are a determined woman with a mind of her own. I always thought that was a defect in a woman.
Ooh, jeez.
So he says that, but he's obviously turned around it. But he can still say something ridiculous like that, but he's actually understanding that it isn't a defect. Of course, it never was.
And he says it in that smug way, too, that sort of, John Houseman voice.
Yeah. And there's another little thing here. Yeah. He has these little, Jamie says to him, I must admit, doctor, that you have done some amazing things. He says, I am beginning to think the biggest thing in nature is man's ego, his claim to omnipotence, the smallest thing, his real power to control events, his own destiny in particular. And he goes on to say, I don't know. Sometimes it seems the things that aren't really controllable are the best things of all. And they all look out to the ocean and the clouds and the sun coming through. Like, this is a message that almost clubbed me in the head. Like, they just really went after the message.
Yeah. And the whole episode is about basically the imminent death of Oscar. It's called Kill Oscar. And Oscar is beaming as he's listening to these pearls of wisdom by this evil scientist who had kidnapped him. It's like, you know, he's not sitting there going, yeah, fuck you. You know, he's like, yes, he's smiling, you know, yes, so true, so true.
But anyways, I guess we should get back to, but those are my thoughts. And definitely, I do recommend the Kill Oscar. It's cool, as you said. First episode was on Bionic Woman. The second one was $6 Million Man, the Return to Bionic. It's very cool at the very beginning of the third part that this is the Bionic Woman emphasis. So then she had been injured and whatever. So she, of course, isn't as face forward in the second episode because that's a $6 Million Man episode. But then, of course, she's all okay now at the beginning of the third, so she can do her full. It's very smart how they do, because you can't really have the person in the off show being as dominant.
Right.
In the episode of the other series.
So what we're going to do now is, now that we've covered the sort of the essentials of both series. We're going to go back to some other notable episodes in both $6 Million Man and The Bionic Woman. So in season three of The $6 Million Man, we get an episode called One of Our Running Backs is Missing. Originally, it aired November 2nd, 1975. It was the first episode directed by Lee Majors. And the whole episode is just a lot of fun. It feels very different from most of the series. It's a very simple premise and one that has been done many times before and since, where a star athlete is kidnapped before a big game and he must be rescued. Part of the fun of the episode is that it features NFL all-stars of the time, like Larry Zonka as Steve's pal, the kidnapped running back. Dick Butkus and pre-Rocky Carl Weathers star as two of the bad guys. And I'm just going to put this out there that Carl Weathers actually played in the CFL. He played for the BC Lions. So he did have football experience and I assume must have played in college too. The episode must have been inspired by the Burt Reynolds film, The Longest Yard, which was released the year before, in which guards play the inmates. The turning point comes when Steve and Zonka's character play a game of pickup football against the former inmates. This episode is also notable for its use of sugar-coated profanities that sound like bad AMC dubbing. At one point, Dick Butkus, and this one like really made me do a double take, Dick Butkus refers to Steve Austin and Zonka as a couple of candy suckers. It's like, did they dub that? And surely they didn't say the other sucker word, but there it was, candy suckers. So I think I may integrate that into my language now.
Some of these are almost better than the original, like, you know, the F-U phrase, and sometimes they say forget you, right?
Right.
When it comes to, and I think almost forget you is almost a stronger or a more powerful thing to say.
Yeah. And you get the, I guess the now common shut the front door type of thing.
Yes. By the way, just as Happy Days had an actual jumping the shark episode that's become iconic. People refer to the phrase jumping the shark because of it. Both this $6 million man and Bionic Woman had episodes where they had to deal with sharks, simply entitled Sharks. Steve's adventures with Jaws kicked off season five in September of 1977, while Jamie fought off sharks in Bionic Woman episode 52, Deadly Music.
But for me, the great thing about season five of $6 Million Man is that we get the classic crossovers, the return of Bigfoot and Kill Oscar, which we just mentioned. We also get a Bionic Christmas Carol that dropped in December of 1976. But I think I pretty much switched allegiances around this time. I really did not like the look of Steve Austin with a mustache. So I just moved over to the Bionic Woman and stayed there, except when there was a crossover episode. The good news about season five of $6 Million Man, yes, the mustache is gone. And that's about it. With Bionic Woman moving networks for its final season, there'd be no Jamie on the $6 Million Man. And that was sort of a sad thing.
But it's nice that the series got sort of a rebirth on another network. That doesn't happen that often.
No.
Along with that final Bigfoot episode, season five of $6 Million Man gave us Deadly Countdown, a two-parter starring Jenny Agutter of Logan's Run and later An American Werewolf in London. We now present a few notable episodes of Bionic Woman.
All righty. Well, in season one, we had Bionic Beauty, in which Oscar sends Jamie undercover and enters her in the Miss America beauty pageant as Miss California. Now, if this premise sounds familiar, it should, because basically it's the plot of the 2000 film Miss Congeniality. And what's even weirder is that the star of that film was Sandra Bullock, who would play a bionic woman in the 1989 TV movie Bionic Showdown. It's just a strange old world, ain't it, pal?
Yeah, it is, pal. I'm going to take my glasses off for effect.
Oh, there you go.
This is a podcast, not a webcast.
Yeah.
But I've just taken off my glasses. You're right, pal.
I think the viewers could feel that one. The viewers. Yeah. Sorry. The listeners. Viewer. Yeah. The remote viewers. In season two, we get a whack at Jamie undercover as a blank stories. Case in point, in this corner, Jamie Summers, in which Jamie went undercover as a wrestler. The Road to Nashville, where Jamie went undercover as a country singer. Sister Jamie, where Jamie's undercover as a nun.
But you made up that last one. You made up that nun one. Come on.
No.
Be real for a second.
Nuns on the Bionic Run. That's a for real one, for sure.
Wow.
And that is that's the episode where Oscar says to the nuns, sisters, you have to get the flock out of here. Referring to a shop of fleek. Jeez, a flock of sheep. But there's also the excellent two-parter Doomsday is Tomorrow, which I would say to people, if you are in a situation where you can pick and choose episodes, like that is one you want to see. It's a two-parter where Jamie is forced to do battle with a supercomputer that is trying to wipe out humanity. Kind of War Games meets Hell from 2001.
The only thing that can trigger the device is an airburst of a nuclear bomb.
So you intend to blackmail the world into peace.
And this will be my final chance to bring a lasting peace to mankind. It is done. The Doomsday device is controlled by Alex. Alex is the master computer that controls every phase of this complex. He's the highest form of computer art and design. The choice is clear and simple, my friends. It is peace or oblivion.
Then we are agreed. We shall institute a worldwide ban on nuclear testing.
We will continue with our nuclear research on schedule.
But that would trigger the Doomsday device.
Detonation of the Doomsday device will be in 6 hours.
You realize that I have to get to the central core of this complex and stop this from happening, don't you?
You will die if you make the attempt.
So, then it is a duel between you and me.
Yes. May the best one win.
Black Magic was another episode that was a lot of fun. Co-starred Vincent Price, Julie Newmar, Abe Vigoda, and Jamie as an undercover boho gypsy. It's kind of like Scooby-Doo meets Agatha Christie, and what can be wrong with that?
Nothing can be wrong with that. Vincent Price, he's someone that we should just do an episode on just himself. Incredible.
Yeah.
Season three of The Bionic Woman was picked up by NBC. That meant no more Steve crossovers, no more classroom scenes, because the network felt it was a financial burden to employ a dozen children who could only work a limited number of hours a day. So the children were replaced with a German Shepherd, Max, the bionic dog. And oh yes, we got a love interest named Chris that nobody asked for. Among the handful of decent season three episodes of Bionic Woman, where the bionic dog motorcycle Boogie with Evel Knievel, and that just sounds made up again. I'm sorry. I apologize, but that, wow.
Well, you know what? If I can talk to that one for a second,
I want
to say, before I watched it, I'd heard a lot about this episode where both Lindsay Wagner kind of hated Evel Knievel and Evel Knievel also hated her. And that shooting went twice as long as it was supposed to because both of them would spend time avoiding the other in their trailers and until they were like, no, you have to come do this scene. And every scene in this episode, they're together. Which I thought, you know, as a guest star, I thought, well, maybe he'll be in a few scenes. No, every scene they're together and working closely together because through a lot of it, she's riding on the back of his motorcycle because they end up stuck in East Germany and they're trying to escape East Germany And they, spoiler, end up doing it by jumping the border back into West Germany. But they work really closely together. And kudos especially to Lindsay Wagner, because her acting is excellent. And Evil is not an actor. You know, he's not so good, but it's a fun episode, and they pull it off despite the tension between them.
Well, when I visited you and we did a whole bunch of episodes, we didn't watch this one specifically, but you did tell me the story about the motorcycle and him driving off with Lindsay Wagner, which may have made her not very happy with him.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there was on one day they were supposed to start shooting a scene. And so she gets on the back of Evil's bike, and he just took off somewhere and rode like 2 hours away. And the whole time she's screaming and like pounding on his back, and he was intentionally just terrorizing her. And, you know, finally they came back 2 hours later.
Wow. I'm not sure if one can get away with that nowadays, because,
oh no,
no. So anyways, continuing with, some of the episodes, On the Run, the series finale, which seems to owe a debt to the prisoner. Jamie wants out of the OSI, so she tries to escape. The agency tracks her down, and she agrees to work for them when she pleases and on her terms. Her priority will be teaching. This episode seems to mirror precisely how Lindsay Wagner was feeling about doing the show. She definitely wanted out. I think that's the same with a number of actors that are the main, who carry the burden of a show with the long 10, 12, 14, 16 hour days for years. It gets to a point where you're doing very well, but it almost feels like just for your own sanity, for your own relationship, for your life, for everything else, you just say no to the money, no to returning, and just stepping away from the show. It should be mentioned that Lindsay Wagner won the 1977 Emmy Award for Best Actress in a Dramatic Series for The Bionic Woman.
Yeah, there's a reason other than, you know, she's very attractive in her sort of own natural kind of way. But she makes the character so believable. She sells this character so well. And I do think that there is a lot of her own person in that character, especially as it develops over the course of the Bionic Woman series.
Colonel Steve Austin, the $6 million man, and the new Bionic Transport and Repair Station.
The rocket's crashing! We'll put him in the Bionic Repair Station. We can rebuild him. We'll replace the modules in the Bionic arm. No injury here. We'll have to check his eye. Bionic eye, A-OK. $6 million man, ready for action.
New Bionic Transport and Repair Station sold separately. The $6 million man, new from Kenner.
It's the Fembot, new from Kenner. And Jamie Summers, the Bionic Woman, sold separately.
I'm Jamie Summers.
Oh, no, you're not. I am. You're a Fembot.
Your paralyzer gave you away.
She's a masked me. Now I have to disguise myself as a mystery baby. No one will recognize me. Not even Jamie. Ha ha.
Fembot comes with everything seen here. Jamie Summers, the Bionic Woman, sold separately.
Is that the $6 million man?
No, it's Maskatron, the robot.
Here's Steve Austin.
At last we meet.
Look out, Steve.
Maskatron will conquer you.
Take that, Maskatron, and that.
Ow!
And that. Steve will beat him every time.
No, he won't. Maskatron will be back in another disguise.
Maskatron, new from Kenner. $6 million man sold separately.
Kenner's new Oscar Goldman with exploding briefcase.
I have a secret assignment for a $6 million man.
It's in my briefcase. Careful, if it's open wrong, it'll self-destruct.
Check video scanner.
Oscar will contact headquarters.
Your order, Steve.
Hey!
Maskatron, here's the briefcase.
Look out, it'll blow apart.
Arrgh. Oscar Goldman with exploding briefcase, $6 million man and Maskatron, each sold separately.
Well, we should talk a little bit all of the toys and merch that were related to our bionic heroes. $6 million man hit all of the merchandise buttons, all of them. There are even posters, of course, of Lee Majors and his wife, Farrah Fawcett, which was like probably the biggest selling poster of that era, maybe of all time. I'm not sure, but we know it did well. And Farrah and Lee were one of the first modern day power couples, come to think of it. Long before Bennifer and Bradgelina and Tay-Tay and Kelsey, there was Leifer. And really, Lee Majors was a part of two power couples, Lee and Farrah and Steve and Jamie. Again, steamy.
The two Bionic shows were a goldmine for merchandise. There were all of the standard landfill items like comic books, lunchboxes, lapel buttons, board games, books, records, all of it. There was even a Play-Doh $6 million man set.
As an only child, I was a spoiled brat and had most of the action figures on the market at the time. Hasbro produced the excellent 12-inch G.I. Joes of the late 60s and 70s, complete with Kung Fu Grip. And Mattel gave us Big Jim and his pride-ready pack of pals, Big Josh, Big Jeff, and Big Jesus. I did make up the last one. all of these figures were top-notch. They were durable, they were poseable, and tons of fun. But I did find the 13-inch Steve Austin action figure just too big and cumbersome and kind of clunky. And it always felt like it was in danger of breaking, which was kind of ironic, really, that, you know, the superhero felt like he was going to break. Mm-hmm. And it was so big that it wasn't really compatible with any of the other figures that I had, particularly not the 7-inch figures produced by Mego.
There were initially 65,000 $6 million Man action figures released just in the year 1975. Other figures followed. There was a Bionic Woman doll and Oscar, a Bigfoot, Fembots, and Maskatron. The figures were discontinued when both shows were canceled in 1978. Today, the figures go for $100 and up. In the season 4 episode, A Bionic Christmas Carol, Steve is in a toy store and we can clearly see the $6 million man action figure in the background. That's kind of cool, isn't it?
It's very meta. I like it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, not only because it's not just like they even reboxed it and made it like the Bionic. No, that, I guess people wouldn't know he's Bionic either. They certainly wouldn't know the price tag. That would be pretty funny. Well, I guess your secret's out, Steve.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. People know about him already. It reminds me a bit of the fun that they have with Jurassic Park, where they've got this whole room full of Jurassic Park things because they're trying to push the store. So yeah, that's very meta, and it's very cool for them to do that, to throw that in there.
Episode 100 of the $6 Million Man, which was entitled The Moving Mountain. And in this episode, it's almost a little bit of a return to the Bondian idea. Oh, and so yeah, this, did I just say that it's the final episode of the series? I probably did. Okay, well, there you go. It is the final episode of the series, and it's the 100th episode. And it kind of does return to the Bondian-like thing, because it's the Cold War, which it was, and there's a terrorist who is able to, I guess, hack or steal these Russian and American, let's just call it a threat, because I don't recall if it was a physical thing or if he has like just the codes to nuclear weapons, but nuclear weapons. And anyway, Steve ends up on this adventure with this Russian spy, a woman, and there's a lot of sexual tension throughout the episode. And when they save the day, by the way, the actress's name was Lisa Feringer, who played the Russian Andrea Mastrova. They end up in a hotel room together, and I think they say they're going to stay there for a week or so. And the final shot of the final episode is the two of them kissing, and it's a freeze frame with them lip locked, which I thought was kind of interesting that we ended up back in that spot. Also, some things that were still there were the epaulettes. He's wearing a shirt with epaulettes on his shirt in the final episode. It's like, yes, okay, nicely done. And one of the things, one of the few things that I did not like, at least through the rewatch of the series, was the persistence of bongos in the score. Mm. There's like constantly bongos back there. And in this final episode, there was also bongos, even though it was whatever year it was then, 1978. I thought we might have moved on from that. But that's just a couple of the notes that I have on that final episode. But my point is, and we'll get around to this too in a minute, that although that was the last episode of $6 Million Man, it was not all we would ever see for both Steve and Jamie. Thank God, because I think people would not have been happy with that. Mm. But let's talk a little bit about how it all ends. Now, this is a segment that we've played around with a bit this season. The idea is for us to create closure for shows that were canceled without a proper return to dramatic equilibrium. But really, the three post-series TV movies did provide closure. And before that, Jamie's episode did give us a suitable finish.
Here's what Harv Bennett had to say about the final $6 Million Man. I would have probably sent Steve to Mars. My last episode would have been the liftoff. After 5 years of earthbound adventures, it would have been Godspeed to Steve Austin to another planet and another life.
That would have been interesting. Well, my only thought is that I would have liked to have seen a bookend to the opening of the pilot, where we saw Steve crossing the desert and walking towards us. This time it would be the hero, the Christ, walking away from us into the desert, into the sunset, like the good cowboy that he is. Dave, you had some thoughts on that too.
Yeah, when it comes to, and I like this idea of, you know, what happened to them after, because a lot of these series, they just didn't end properly. The one thing I had was Oscar Goldman. Because I think what happens is he finally gets that eye surgery and he no longer has to worry about taking off his glasses or putting them on, which was great exercise, by the way. I mean, it's probably
that's right,
a good way of keeping in shape, keeping the arm muscles going and keeping active. But I think he either gets that surgery, which I can't remember the name for, but it's the one where they slice the eye, that basically you can get back to 20/20 vision. My eyes are so bad, by the way, that I've investigated it, and my eyes aren't good enough for me to actually have that surgery myself. But if he could, great. If not, bionic eyes. Like, why not?
Yeah.
So he can have some bionic eyes. When it comes to Steve and Jamie, that's something I haven't really given a lot of thought about, because, you know, you just hope that there's some sunset thing, or maybe they're the ones that are like the retired, extremely dangerous bunch. Like, they can actually join that franchise of films and actually do this. But in fact, it's like their real life. They're the ones that are still out there doing, like, the Smith and Smith. But I was thinking more that they still had the bionic, they still have the powers, and they're still making a difference out there.
Oh, that would be good. We have to touch on the fact that there were three post-cancellation TV movies that brought Steve and Jamie together, including one from 1994, where they are finally married, that was called Bionic Ever After.
There's a nice symmetry to the fact that before either show became TV series, we had three $6 Million Man TV movies. And the franchise got to have closure with the three $6 Million Man Bionic Woman TV movies in the 80s and 90s. And in Bionic Ever After, we had the nice touch of Rudy giving away the bride, Jamie Summers.
We are gathered here today to join in the holy state of matrimony, Jamie Summers and Steve Austin.
I do.
Not yet.
You do, huh?
Yes, I sure do.
Wait a minute. We haven't come to that part yet.
Yeah, we have.
Summers take Steve Austin to be your lawful wedded husband, to have and to hold, to cherish in sickness and in health, forevermore, till death do you part? Excuse me, now you can say that. I now pronounce you husband and wife.
Way to go, pal.
And we're pretty much done here, Dave. You know, I didn't think we'd get a Fall Guy feature film before a $6 million man film, but you know, maybe that's for the better. And how great was Lee Majors' cameo at the beginning of Scrooged, where he appears in a Christmas special called The Night the Reindeer Died?
Yeah, we covered that before in one of our Christmas shows. And I, you know, you were the one that suggested me watching Scrooge. And maybe it was at that time I just wasn't into watching it. But watching it, wow, that opening with Lee Majors.
Yeah.
So great. So definitely anyone out there listening to this podcast and you haven't seen the movie Scrooged, please watch it, because that's almost, it's almost like Tropic Thunder with those fake openings.
Yeah.
It's almost the best part of the film, or in one of the Austin Powers, maybe the third one, Goldmember, where they have different people playing the roles and they're actually filming a version of Austin Powers, where you've got different actors and actresses doing the parts. It's just brilliant. So I loved the Majors in Scrooge. So anyways, that's basically where we're just about to wrap up. But we have a special treat for you.
That's right. We asked sci-fi legend Robert J. Sawyer for his favorite $6 million man episodes. And this is what he had to say.
The $6 Million Man is based on a novel by Martin Caden called Cyborg, which is a perfectly serviceable techno thriller. The TV series, by and large, was also plot-driven, and really you couldn't say much about a given episode but that Sasquatch or the Death Probe or a Fembot or some other enemy was defeated by the super strength of the $6 Million Man. When the series shone is when it did things that actually dealt thematically with the issue of whether you can enhance the human body and still retain your humanity. So the very best of the $6 Million Man incarnations is the pilot film, which was called The $6 Million Man, aired in March 1973 with a screenplay by Henri Simoun, which is a pseudonym for Howard Rodman Sr. And it dealt with it's the story of Cyborg, the novel, but some significant changes. In the novel, Steve Austin, as he was in the TV series, is a United States Air Force colonel and really had been chain of command, would do whatever he was ordered to do, was not conflicted in the slightest. He was essentially had, as any soldier going through boot camp, had been made into an automaton. And when he became one, quite literally, it made no psychological difference to him. In the pilot film, astonishing for 1973, Steve Austin is suicidal. Steve Austin is impotent. The gorgeous Barbara Anderson wants to have relations with him, and he can't do it. This film was nominated for the Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation of the Year, lost to Woody Allen's Sleeper. Never again did the series reach the power of that. But it came close when, in an episode which I go back and forth, I have two favorites about which is the better of the two. Peter Allen Fields, who went on to be a mainstay for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, wrote an episode called The $7 Million Man. Couldn't do anything dramatic with the Steve Austin character, become so anodyne by that point. He was just Mr. Perfect guy who would, you know, have a wry little smile as he would use his bionics, but had no emotional impact on anything. So he created a new character, Barney Miller, the same name as the TV series that came out about the same time, who was the world's second cyborg and could not handle the difference. He said in the great speech when Steve says, "You're too valuable to human being to give it all up." And Barney says, valuable. Let me tell you what value was. I ran, drove the fastest race cars in the world, and I did it better than anybody else alive. Indy, Le Mans, everything. I won it all. That had value because it was me, flesh and blood, Barney Miller, human being. Man, I do anything now. It's just wires and nuclear muscles. Doesn't matter, right? And the emotional impact of that episode, the whole series could have been like that if they'd kept in the vein of the pilot film, but they did not. So pilot film, The $6 Million Man, and watch the pilot film, the original 90-minute pilot film. On the DVDs and Blu-rays, you will find the syndicated version called The Moon in the Desert, where they stretch it out to 2 hours. They add they did bring back Martin Balsam, the first actor, to play Steve Austin's bionic surgeon, Dr. Rudy Wells, to do voiceover. But it's a terrible bastardization of the brilliant pilot film. The pilot is also in the Blu-ray and DVD set. Watch that. That's number one, $6 million man. Number two, $7 million man. Number three, The Last Kamikaze, written by Judy Burns. Judy also wrote The Tholian Web for the original Star Trek. And it's about what the title says, a kamikaze pilot who doesn't know that World War II is over. And Steve has to go and explain to this man, not only is it over, but Japan has lost. And it changed my whole life, that episode, 1974, because for the first time ever in anything that I'd ever seen in American pop culture, somebody expressed regret about the bombing of Japan. And it was Steve Austin who said a lot of Americans wish we had never done that. First time I'd ever heard any American say that. And the putative heroes say it. Enormously powerful episode. John Fujikawa plays the kamikaze pilot Kuroda, and you will be in tears at the end of that episode. Something that never happens when Sasquatch is the enemy. DC Fontana wrote two of the best. She, of course, was associated with Star Trek in the first season. She did so, and I was worried because she did what could have been a jumping of the shark. She introduced extraterrestrials into $6 Million Man with an episode called Straight On Till Morning with Meg Foster guest starring as an alien. But it was done with, of course, Dorothy Fontana's usual intelligence. Her other episode that she wrote was called The Rescue of Athena One, where Farrah Fawcett, who was married to Lee Majors at the time, guest stars as Major Kelly Woods, the United States' first female astronaut. And she gets she's up in orbit with an explosion aboard her Apollo capsule. Her co-pilot is severely injured. Steve has to go up along with a surgeon to Skylab to try to save this this guy's life and bring them back. So DC Fontana's contributions, also the best. There was, I'll give one final one. After the pilot film, which Richard Irving produced, brought in Glenn Larson and had him retool it for two more 90-minute movies, very much in a James Bond mold. There was a theme song sung by Dusty Springfield, and Steve Austin was wearing tuxedos and playing in casinos and was surrounded by Bond girl type babes, including Britt Eklund, who actually went on to be a Bond girl babe. It's not $6 Million Man as you know it, but it's incredibly stylish. And the guest cast is unbelievable. Besides Britt Eklund, it has Eric Braeden. It has Lee Bergey, who is a Lincoln on Star Trek. It introduces the Richard Anderson, Oscar Goldman character. Best of all, David McCollum, of course, from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. He was Ilya Kuryakin, but here he's playing a Russian cosmonaut. Steve Austin, of course, is an American astronaut. It is fun. It is fast-paced. It is gigantic spectacle with special effects by Robert Kinoshita, who designed the robots for Lost in Space and Forbidden Planet and the Jupiter 2 and so forth. And just as its own thing, as $6 Million Man James Bond mashup, it is thoroughly enjoyable. So there you have it. The pilot film, $6 Million Man. The episode, the $7 Million Man. The two DC Fontana episodes. The Rescue of Athena 1 and Straight On Till Morning, and the second 90-minute film, which was called Wine, Women, and War.
Well, we'd like to remind you all that if you're looking for even more Bionic Bounty, please pick up Herbie J. Pilato's excellent The Bionic Book, available through Amazon. And you can also find the podcast Cyborgs out there and the website Bionic Blonde. We want to thank you all for joining us. You're the reason we do the show. However, that was a funny one. However, here's the bad part. Yeah. No. However you listen, we'd ask that you please like, rate, review, and subscribe on whatever platform you use. Please do tell others about our podcast. You can join us on our Facebook page, Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. You can engage with us there or over at the website, 2OF.ca. Let us know what you think.
I'm David Klink.
And I am Troy Harkin.
Thank you for listening to Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi. Thank you so much, man. That
You're
was
very
amazing.
Welcome.
Well, thank cool. you so much for that.
You're so welcome, my friends. All
okay.
right. Cheers.
Have a good night.
Thanks
good
a
night,
lot,
my friends. Bye-bye.
Well, that was a nice bonus treat.
Yeah.